Cross appeal case numbers 21-1242 and 21-1293, Dylan Burnett versus Josh Griffith. Oral argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. William Piper for the appellant. You may proceed.
May it please the court, William Piper appearing on behalf of the plaintiff appellant Dylan Burnett, and he's also the cross appellee. In this case, I'm challenging the district court's ruling that the defendant Griffith was entitled to qualified immunity. Generally, with respect to qualified immunity issues, if a judge makes factual findings or even inferences from the facts, that cannot be challenged for purposes of qualified immunity on appeal. And that's pretty well established from Johnson versus Jones from the United States Supreme Court, Romo versus Largent from the Sixth Circuit. So Judge Jarboe's opinion that the videotape could lead a jury to conclude that Griffith acted with the necessary malice, from my perspective, cannot be challenged. It's a jury issue at that point. The jury, in fact, could conclude that there was no threat imposed by Mr. Burnett, and that the force used by the defendant, Griffith, was clearly excessive.
And can I ask you a question?
Sure.
This is an Eighth Amendment case, right?
Correct.
But why? Because he was convicted, in theory, or I guess in practice, he was convicted of the contempt. Is that why? He wasn't a pretrial detainee. He was a convicted prisoner of the contempt.
Correct.
So he was being booked in for the contempt.
Correct. And it's an unusual situation, but yes, because he was already convicted of contempt.
Okay.
Yes.
So you have to prove malice.
Correct. And certainly Judge Jarboe indicated in her original opinion, before she remanded it to the magistrate for a qualified immunity analysis, that there was clearly enough facts from which malice could be inferred. And the jury could analyze the facts, as I indicated, and say there was no threat imposed and the force was clearly...
The client clearly was trying to break away from Griffith, wasn't it?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
So what is your answer to, well, what about, though, that it wasn't clearly established that he was on fair warning that he would be violating your client's constitution?
Yeah, I mean, I don't even think you get to that point because the jury still has to determine what the facts are. And the jury could determine that, hey, there wasn't any threat whatsoever.
I don't understand, though. What are the disputed facts? It's a video.
Correct.
So when we have a video and it's pretty clearly shows the whole thing, what is a disputed fact?
There is a video, but what the facts are that are disputed would be the threat perceived by the defendant, Griffith. So that is what has to be analyzed regarding the situation. Yeah, you can see the video, but you don't know what is in the mind of the defendant Griffith and what the threat was that he perceived. And certainly there's a lot of facts here that indicates that there shouldn't have been much of a threat whatsoever perceived. Mr. Burnett was a small man. He was handcuffed behind his back. Another officer was in the area. There wasn't any other inmates or what have you in the area. He didn't use any commands towards Mr. Burnett. He didn't ask for assistance from Officer Tesser. He just grabbed him, flung him down, and slammed his head on the ground. So, I think under those circumstances, the factual issue is the threat perceived by the defendant.
How do you distinguish this our prior Sixth Circuit case of Griffin v. Hardwick? This is where the prisoner broke away from the nurse and, you know, was brought to the ground.
Yeah, I distinguish that. I don't think that case is very factually similar whatsoever. I mean, the takedown procedure that was used was a leg sweep. This was, the defendant lifted him, Mr. Burnett, up, flung him from side to side, and slammed his head on the ground. The takedown procedures are totally different. I would say, you know, there's a difference between Greco-Roman wrestling and freestyle wrestling, and that's exactly the situation you have here, where a leg sweep is used to bring someone down, and then the injury that resulted in Griffin versus Hardwick was a broken leg. In this case, that he flung Mr. Burnett from side to side, and the injury that resulted was a head injury. Mr. Burnett had no opportunity to brace his fall because his hands were handcuffed behind his back, and that's a different situation. Here, the Griffin versus Hardwick seemed to be kind of a fluke injury as a result of a leg sweep, and the officer ended up falling on top of the inmate. So I don't see that.
I mean, you know, you don't have any evidence, though, that Sergeant Griffin intended your client to have a head laceration. That was just the consequence of falling to the floor, yeah.
Well, I think there possibly could be evidence that he intended that. The jury is the one who should determine that.
Let's get back to what case establishes, though, that as a matter of law, that it would be clearly established that Sergeant Griffith should have known that what he was doing would be considered. Acceptable.
Again, I don't think you should get to that point, but
I assume we do.
I believe that I'm drawing a blank here. It's Cordell versus McKinney. In that case, the officer was guiding a prisoner down a hallway. The prisoner turned to face the officer, which from my perspective is a lot more of a threat than someone walking away. I mean, if someone turns around and faces the officer, it's, you know, fight or flight situation.
Wait, but in Cordell, he wasn't trying to break away, though, from the officer. He was still under control. He was just turned around wanting to face him.
Yes, I understand, but I think that the threat face is not comparable. Mr. Burnett was small. He may have tried to walk away, but he didn't get away. I mean, the Griffin said that he broke away, which is not true.
What about the fact that he had been fiddling with his handcuffs at the table? I mean, doesn't that suggest to the officers that he's a threat to maybe try to get away or get out or whatever it is?
Well, you can interpret that two ways. You can interpret that in the sense that, well, there could be a threat. Again, that's a jury issue. The jury have to determine, given those facts, whether the officer perceived a threat. It could also be interpreted a different way in that, yeah, those are some things that happened, and that is something that would have angered the officer. And as a result, when Mr. Burnett tried to walk away, that the officer was already upset, grabbed him with malice, flung him from side to side and slammed his head onto the ground. So again, you know, those facts can be interpreted different ways, and it's up to the jury to determine what the facts are as regards whether it's malice or whether that's something that could be perceived as an additional threat.
That's one of the questions that I had. I was trying to understand the argument that there was no jurisdiction, because that's generally raised where there are disputes of material fact. Is it your position that also occurs when there are not necessarily disputes of material fact, but that it is the jury's job to determine whether those facts rise to the level of malice? It seemed to me that was what the district court was getting at, as opposed to disputes of fact, because there's the video, but that it was the jury's job to say, I'm looking at all these facts and I think that's evidence of malice, or I think it's not. So if that's the case, wouldn't we have jurisdiction?
I think that's still a factual determination that the jury has to make, whether or not there was malice. And sufficient malice under the circumstances, that's a factual question. So the judge in its original ruling, the district judge, basically said it's up to the jury to determine whether that arises.
What that means, because we're in the world of malice or not, right?
Yes.
But is that right? I mean, we have like excessive force, probable cause, those are legal questions, right, that we evaluate. And ultimately, this is a constitutional tort. We're just trying to decide, somebody's got to decide whether the Eighth Amendment was violated. Why wouldn't it fall under that same rubric? The historical facts are what they are. Like in a Fourth Amendment case, historical facts are what they are. We judges decide whether there was probable cause, right? It doesn't go to a jury. I mean, so why wouldn't this?
I'm not sure that's correct. I think that under certain cases,
we could dispute it, but I mean, I'm just saying, I think that's the way it is. You could dispute whether as an original matter that should be correct or not, but I think, you know, we or excessive force, you know, the Graham question, there have been questions about that, but I think it's generally is a legal question after the historical facts are decided. I mean, I don't know, maybe malice is a exception to that, or that's a traditional jury question, like at a common law tort it would be. I think,
as I've been trying to argue all along, I think the issue of malice and what the threat was that the defendant in this case perceived is a question for the jury. I mean, they could decide that there was hardly any threat whatsoever, or a more serious threat, as you indicated, because of the behavior of Mr. Burnett beforehand. But that's for a jury to decide, and so I don't think that the issue could be decided on qualified immunity. I would also like to indicate regarding...
Are you saying that we wouldn't need to get to... Why would we... We would then have to look at clearly established law, I take it, right? What is your... I'm confused by your argument of why we wouldn't have to do that.
Well, if there are facts left to be determined, the application of what is clearly established to the facts would be difficult if you don't know exactly what the facts are to be determined.
Well, no, because let's assume that the jury would find that there was malice. Hmm. We'd still then have to face the two-part test of whether you're entitled to, Griffith is entitled to qualified immunity depends on was it clearly established at the time.
Okay, well, I've been trying to make my point. I'll certainly get to the next point.
You've got a minute and 20 seconds, so get
exactly.
to it.
I would submit to the court that the judge made an error in its qualified immunity analysis by saying that because Mr. Burnett caused the exigency, then that's somehow a distinguishing fact. That's not part of the Eighth Amendment analysis. So I think the court erred when it said, well, Mr. Burnett caused the exigency by walking away, and therefore he's not the defendant is entitled to qualified immunity.
Why is that? I'm confused about that point, because aren't there cases that say, like, during a prison riot situation, the officers are authorized to do certain things that they wouldn't be authorized to do if it wasn't. Why is this not like that?
But I think the issue is not who caused the exigency, it's the amount of threat that the officer perceived. And certainly the fact that someone walks away or whatever, maybe that is part of the threat analysis, but it's not dispositive regarding the issue. And so I guess I would like to say that I think that Cordell versus McKinney is clear regarding established law, because the force used in that case was less than it was here, and the injuries here were more severe, and there's plenty of case law out there indicating that if someone is, you know, slammed headfirst to the ground, that does not comport with contemporary standards of decency. So I think if Cordell versus McKinney, based on the prior case law, was clearly established, those facts, and then I think when you have Cordell versus McKinney itself, then that I can rely on, and in this case, then I believe that the law is clearly established.
Yeah. Thank you. You'll have your rebuttal time.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. Jeffrey Garish on behalf of Officer Griffith. It's good to be back in person. I agree, Judge Strange. Thank you for holding oral argument and for holding it live. It's nothing quite like it, and we appreciate it. I certainly have much to say about qualified immunity, but I want to start with the issue that we raised on cross appeal. And the reason it's important, which is our argument, is that there was no constitutional violation to begin with. And the reason that matters is because the way the case was disposed of, he's entitled to bring his state law claims in tort in state court, and he shouldn't be allowed to do that.
Is that the way that you would distinguish the Wheeler case?
I'm sorry?
Our decision in Wheeler.
Our decision in Wheeler?
Wheeler. There's a case we have called Wheeler where we dismiss a cross appeal for lack of jurisdiction. And the in this scenario, this qualified immunity scenario where someone is trying to say, no, it's the constitutional problem that I'm challenging, not just clearly established. Right.
Right.
Okay. And I take it, and we said no jurisdiction. And I think one of the questions, perhaps it's open or not, was whether, I think there wasn't additional relief being asked for. So the cross appellant has to be asking to expand the judgment, right?
Correct. Yes.
So your expansion of the judgment would be dismissal of the state claims with prejudice. Is
correct.
That right?
That's correct.
You're okay.
And essentially, that would entail adopting the magistrate's initial ruling. That the magistrate barons got it exactly right. So the court, I understand, the court would have to overturn the district court's rejection of that. But we would urge the court to adopt those rulings because
we can also affirm your victory on an alternative ground. I assume, is that right?
Yes. Okay. I think that's
so
correct.
We could say we're going to go ahead and look at prong one. What he did wasn't unconstitutional. As a consequence of that, the state law, I mean, that's what happened in Griffin, right? The state law claims fell away right. when the federal claims did on prong one, right?
Correct. I think that's right, yes. And Griffin, to our mind, is directly on point. I know, Judge Gilman, you authored Griffin. We think it's on all fours with this case.
What is your response on this on the question of malice and whether that has to go to a jury?
Well, my response is to point to Rudlaff versus Gillespie and other cases where this court has recognized that when you have an incident that's captured on video, the court looks at the facts in light of what's depicted on the video. I mean, there's been no suggestion that the video doesn't accurately depict what happened. I mean, there's no suggestion of that. So the court can
see.
Isn't
the question what your opposing counsel says is that the issue is whether it's malice, what you can infer from the video itself and the earlier videos, because we've got videos of him taking his handcuffs off at the bench, and all of those things, I thought the judge fairly wisely said, I think that is entrusted to a jury.
Yeah, and I guess I just have to agree to disagree with Your Honor and the judge. You're right, Judge Strange, that the court can base a finding of malice on inferring what's clearly depicted on a video if the video allows that inference. And our position is it simply does not allow that inference. And if you look at the constitutional
and
test.
So if the judge looks at the videos and says, I think it allows that inference and I think a jury ought to make it, what is your best argument for why she was wrong? I mean, isn't that her call?
It's not her call. I just think it's the wrong call as a matter of law. I guess that's my argument.
This seems odd to me because if it were just an objective test, isn't there still an objective component here? Like if this were just an objective test, you'd look at the video and say a reasonable officer would have perceived somebody trying to get away from them and would have grabbed them in light of the video. But if you make it subjective only, then it can't be the case that everything is a jury question, because somebody could look at it and say, well, I think maybe that person had, yes, that's a reasonable officer, but he was a reasonable officer with bad intent, and therefore that's a constitutional problem. I mean, the Eighth Amendment standard is supposed to be, in some sense, harder to meet than the 14th Amendment standard, right?
Exactly.
But this would be turning it on its head, wouldn't it?
Yes, I think it would, Your Honor. And let me, if I may, just point to something that the court said in Griffith, which I think is helpful here. The court said in Griffith that the court has previously cautioned that an official's decision to use force is entitled to deference. That's important. And the court also said because the officials must make their decisions in haste, under pressure, and frequently without the luxury of a second chance. So then the question becomes, affording Officer Griffith the wide-ranging deference to which he's entitled, was the use of, could the use of force plausibly have been thought necessary? That's the Eighth Amendment test. Could the use of force depicted on the video plausibly have been thought necessary? And we submit the answer has to be yes. There's really two questions. One is...
That's an objective question?
It is. I think it is an objective question.
Could a reasonable officer have thought that...
Could plausibly have... Yes, exactly. Could a reasonable officer have plausibly thought this amount of force was necessary? There can be no question that some force was allowed, because this court has repeatedly held, not just in Griffith, but in Bagley and other cases, that when you have a resisting detainee, even a resisting arrestee, but a resisting prisoner in the Eighth Amendment context, resisting, you're entitled to use force.
So well, then here's the question, isn't it? And it's the distinction that seems to me to really matter between Griffin and Cordell. The difference between those two cases is that Cordell's was, that Griffin was in, I've got to make sure I've got the right one, was in, the difference is the conduct that led to it. Isn't the key whether the prisoner was in handcuffs? And isn't that the distinction between Griffin and Cordell? Because in it's the difference between someone who can be controlled because they are in handcuffs and then they're injured because of the action of the officer, versus someone who is out of control and has no restraint on them at the time. And that person is distinct from what you can do to somebody who is controllable by the fact that that person has handcuffs tied behind his back. Why doesn't that make a difference in whether you choose Griffin or Cordell?
Well, I didn't find Cordell distinguishing Griffin on that basis, Your Honor. I thought the distinction was that the detainee in Cordell didn't do anything to resist. The officer just started pushing him quickly down a hall and shoved him into a wall, and all he did was turn around and ask, why are you doing this? Whereas in Griffin is exactly like this case. The detainee resisted restraint, as Judge Gilman pointed out, and the officer did a leg sweep and took her down. And then my brother's argument that the injury was less severe because it was a broken leg, I certainly disagree with that. I mean, I think if anything, a cut on the forehead is not as severe as a broken leg. But let me just be very blunt here. What was Officer Griffith supposed to do? I mean, it's easy in hindsight to say that he could have restrained him by doing something less, but what specifically should he have done? I think it's important to keep in mind that they weren't nearby a wall. So when you have an officer and you have a detainee pulling away, he tried to pull him back, he pulled away again. When there's no wall around, the only way he can restrain him is to take him to the ground. That's the only way he can do it, because otherwise he can't control his legs. I mean, you can say that he could bear hug him and lift him up, but he's not controlling his legs. So to me, he had, and just as a matter of looking at it rationally, he could have done really only one of two things. He could have pulled him away and tried to take him to the ground that way, or he could have tackled him this way. And I would submit if he does that.
Is it Tesler, the other officer, was right there?
He wasn't close enough to help with the restraint. If you look at the video, I don't remember exactly.
He was standing at the door and turned around. And I mean, your opposing counsel suggests that there was another officer there to help. And I'm asking you if that doesn't make a difference.
Yeah, I don't think it does. He was in the room. But when you have Officer Griffith holding him and he's trying to pull away, at that point, under the case law, he's absolutely entitled to try to restrain him. And the only way he can restrain him is to take him to the ground. And the best way to do that is to do it the way he did. If he tackles him and lands on him, then we wouldn't be talking about a cut on the forehead. We'd probably be talking about broken bones on his face. The question is, under the circumstances that were foisted on Officer Griffith by Burnett, could that use of force plausibly have been thought necessary? Now, my brother said it's not fair that the judge set a pox on your house because you caused this. That's not really what the judge said. I mean, the reality is he did cause this. But the point is, what were the circumstances that Officer Griffith was faced with? They were the circumstances of a detainee pulling away. He tried to pull him back. He pulled away even harder. At that point, he absolutely was entitled to use force, and he used the best use of force that he could have made, I would submit, and at a minimum, it's force that could plausibly have been thought necessary. And so that's why we think there's no constitutional violation at all, and there is no question of fact because it's all been depicted on the video.
You know, if we, though, thought, well, we don't disagree, we might disagree with your thought that there's no, that's the basis of your cross appeal, but we do decide that, let's say there was no clearly established law that would have made it a violation, would your cross appeal then be moot? I mean, there would be no need to reach your issue if we just affirm on the basis the district court ruled.
I think you could do that. I think I'm entitled to a ruling on my cross appeal, though. But if you were to issue an opinion that said we affirm the court's judgment and we decline to reach the issue on cross appeal, whether you have discretion to do what you want, I guess.
And that's what this court did in this Wheeler case that I guess Judge Malabandian was right.
But I think that if we said we affirm no clearly established law and affirm the dismissal of the state claims for lack of supplemental jurisdiction or in our discretion, then you're in that state of the world, your cross appeal is mooted.
Correct.
I mean,
I can do is urge the court to decide our constitutional question on cross appeal, even if the court doesn't think it has to, because the facts are clear, the law is clear. We are going to end up in state court unnecessarily, and I think inappropriately, because the actions of Officer Griffith simply didn't violate the Constitution, and they didn't violate the state law standard either, which is why I say Judge Barron's got it right, and that's what we would urge the court to find as well. I do want to spend just a couple minutes on qualified immunity. I think it's very straightforward. I also, Judge Nalbandian, didn't understand Mr. Piper's argument as to why you shouldn't get to the question of whether it's clearly established. I think you have to get there for his argument, because that's the issue. Is it clearly established that Officer Griffith's actions were violated clearly established law at the time under the circumstances that he faced? And the answer to that is it absolutely was not clearly established. Griffin is the case that's most directly on point. Cordell is a completely different character of action and a much more severe use of force and a worse injury. Counsel said a broken leg is not as bad as a cut on the forehead. I disagree with that, but that's just the tip of the iceberg. And if you look at Cordell, and we've distinguished Cordell in our brief, but I just want to mention today, you have a hostile officer who is hostile for no cause. He takes the guy, he shoves him down the hall for no reason, shoves him into a wall, he continues to be hostile, and he was reprimanded for it. I mean, that is about as distinguishable from this case as a case could get. Whereas Griffin v. Hardwick is really right on point.
Except that the woman wasn't handcuffed and therefore was maybe more of a threat, as Judge Strange points out.
Fair enough, but she was resisting. The point is an officer, was it clearly established that a resisting detainee, even one in handcuffs, cannot be restrained with force? I would submit that's not even a constitutional violation, but at a minimum, it's not clearly established that it was. I mean, it's not just Griffin, but it's the Bagley.
What's the underlying right of the officer or goal of the officer in distinguishing these two cases? What would you say the right of the officer is? Because it seems to me that the law is speaking to the right and the necessity of the officer being able to gain control in the circumstances, right?
That's fair.
Yeah, and then thereby protect officers and any other civilians or even private property, which is kind of what the argument is here. So give us your best explanation to why it's not a key that this plaintiff was in handcuffs and that that governs the ability to gain control in the circumstances. And the danger is someone who is not in handcuffs.
I would say 2 points to that. Number one, he had already broken free of his handcuffs once, so he was already showing resistance and belligerence. And number two, even when he's in handcuffs, when he's trying to pull away and the officer pulls him back, and then he tries to pull away even harder, if he's able to get away, you don't know what kind of mischief he might cause. And under the case,
he's going to cause less mischief with his hands locked behind his body than the woman who was fighting everybody and waving her arms and arguing with them. I mean, isn't that reality?
But I don't know that she was in any greater position to cause harm than a detainee, even in handcuffs, who had already gotten out of them once, who had already threatened to shoot any officer if he finds out that any officer mistreated a detainee. He has repeatedly shown belligerence, and I would submit the case law is very clear that an officer is entitled to restrain a resisting detainee, even one in handcuffs. I think that's what the case law provides. I see that my time is up. Thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honors, in the district judge's original opinion, it stated, in responding to Burnett's actions, Griffith used a great deal of force. He did so while Burnett was handcuffed and Officer Tesser was nearby and capable of helping. Griffith had less forceful alternatives. Although it is not the court's job to second-guess the officer's actions in fast-developing situations, it is also not the court's job to take on the role of the jury. But I think there are jury issues here regarding what was the threat that was perceived and whether the amount of force used was reasonable under the circumstances, and whether Griffith acted with malice. I agree with Judge Stranch in the sense that Griffith versus Hardwick is much different from this case because of the handcuff situation. I cited in the brief not only Cordell versus McKinney, but a lot of other cases, including Phelps versus Coy, there's other cases there, in which the Sixth Circuit has held that, and other circuits, that if someone is handcuffed and generally under the control of the officer.
What is your response to the argument about in hindsight, what was he supposed to do?
Well, I think
just
that
grab him or throw him up against the wall, or
he could have asked Officer Tesser for assistance. He could have grabbed him and not lift him up and slam
but
him.
But when does he ask him for his, like, he's starting to pull away and he's supposed to say, hey, you, come over here and help me get this guy before he does. Can he restrain him at that point, or does he have to ask for help first?
Well, generally in circumstances regarding police or corrections officers, you give loud verbal commands, you ask for assistance, and there's other things you could do. He could have pushed him against the wall without using the great deal of force that was used under the circumstances.
Well, he might have cut his head being pushed against the wall.
Well, you're less likely to have that happen than if you're lifted up and slammed head first onto the ground when your hands are handcuffed behind your back and you can't.
Well, Cordell was injured when pushed against the wall.
Yeah, but Cordell's injuries weren't as severe. He wasn't knocked unconscious and things of that nature. But, Cordell, I think, is similar. You can't. The law is clearly established.
How do you respond to your opposing counsel's argument that there was the factual distinctions have to do with the actions of the officer in Cordell that already evidenced malice?
Well, I mean, I think, again, it's a jury issue regarding the malice. I mean, the court found in this case that the jury could determine that there was sufficient malice to make it an Eighth Amendment violation. And there are preceding factual issues not caught on the videotape regarding the Mr. Burnett's behavior in court and with, another videotape. He was taking his handcuffs off and things of that nature. I mean, you could look at that and decide that probably Griffith was pretty angry by the time Mr. Burnett walked away, even though it was
speculating now, right?
Well, but it's up to the jury to determine the amount of malice, and that's what the district court decided, that it should be a jury issue, and I don't think that could be, challenged on qualified immunity. It's the job of the district judge to determine the facts and the inferences from the facts, and the district judge said we're going to allow this to be determined by a jury.
Thank you.
I think the law is clearly established that if you slam a handcuffed individual either against a wall or against the ground when he has no ability to fight back, that's clearly established, and not only in Cordell versus McKinney, but also other cases in the Sixth Circuit and other circuits.
I think your time's up. We thank you both for your good arguments and briefing. They were very helpful. Of course, we will take the case under advisement and render an opinion in due course.